You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Welcome to Psyched by MG. This is Mary Grace Randazzo-Ratliff, or MG for short. I've been a psychotherapist in private practice for 32 years now. Guess what, everyone? We all have issues. So it's time to lighten up and move forward. Let's stop letting our crap control us and take control of our crap.
Hello, everybody.
What is up, people?
Good evening, good evening. Boy, you know, these weeks do not disappoint or beep up with everything that's happening. We have such a special, special guest and a dear friend of mine. Barbara Mangami is on the show with us tonight. Hello, Barbara, and welcome. Ooh,
thank you. Thank you so much, Mary Grace. I appreciate you.
Oh, my gosh. And we're going to really, I think this is going to be such a great show because we're going to get real about racism and what's been going on. But let's first check in and see how everybody's weeks were. This week was interesting. More things have opened up. And so I drove my butt to Home Goods today to find that it was closed. I thought all the stores were open.
I think it depends on the store, because I think a lot of places, I mean, I guess they have the option to be open, just like a lot of restaurants are not open yet because they haven't either prepared or they're just feeling real good about it. I don't know. But I guess it's, you know, they're businesses, so they probably have the choice.
Yeah, I was shocked. They're not opening until the 15th. So, and hair salons are supposed to open on the 15th as well. So, but yeah, I was surprised. But when I kind of got out to look, I was a little nervous. I had my mask on. A lot of people didn't have their mask on. So in some ways, I wanted to just turn around, get right back in the car.
Yeah.
So I've been really trying to help people in practice this week about this issue, to really define for them what they need for themselves and for their families to be safe and how to be responsible. Because people are really getting confused and they're so relieved that everything is opened up. And yet they're scared at the same time and they don't know how much they should do, how they should do it. And so I spent time this week really defining with them.
It's interesting you say that, Mary Grace, because sorry to clear my throat. I just heard a thing on the radio today, you know, FOMO, fear of missing out. There's this new phrase going on, fear of going out. And that's what a lot of people are having. I just heard that on the news today.
Good one.
And even though things are open, people are still a little hesitant. They're still a little concerned.
They're scared. They're scared. And, you know, of course, the protesting issues are going on, and which is a great lead-in for our very special guest and dear friend of mine, Barbara. Now, let me just read some of the things that this woman has done, because it's quite impressive. Barbara is a scholar practitioner in public health epidemiology with a specialization in minority women's sexual and reproductive health. I hope my computer doesn't keep doing that. She is an anti-violence against women, VAW, activist, engaged with several social justice movements globally. She's coordinated the global 1 billion Rising campaign to end violence against women in 6 Southern African countries and in Ann Arbor. She is a published writer. She was a part of the short story Analogy. And Barbara, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
About the writing?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So I'm a writer of what I call realist fiction.
Yeah.
And essentially, I think my writing is realistic in the sense that I write about social issues, but rather than write essays and rather than write commentary, which I do as well, I have found it so effective to talk about social issues in story form, because most people will pick up a novel and read. A lot of people will pick up a short story and read. And it's in the identifying of themselves within that story where the magic happens. And so I've written on race issues. I've written on LGBTQIA issues. I've written on intersectionality. I've written on social justice movements, but in story form.
Yeah.
So, and I found that, and that's why I'm part of a group of people. We call ourselves writivists, in that we are activists, but we use fiction for social change. So that's pretty much what I do.
So impressive. It's so impressive.
Fantastic.
And Barbara and I, you know, we've had, we're friends, and we actually met because I was working on my book, and constantly saying to Barbara, I wasn't a writer, which she corrected me often. And we ended up having so many important conversations that were hard conversations. And we would constantly say as we were having them, right, Barbara,
we need to record this.
We should have recorded this. And we knew our conversations, which we had talked about race issues and the struggles before. And so when we reconnected, we just kind of said to each other, it's time to do what we've always said we were going to do, and talk about the really hard things to talk about. Racism, number one. And to really hopefully model for people on how to do that effectively, especially white people. And it's a hard topic for white people in society. The first thing I want to say is, and there's many things, of course, is this is not if this is happening. This is happening. Like, there is a racial problem in our society.
Well, period. It's always happened. I think that's the key thing.
Yes, Dave. Yeah, absolutely. And so, Barbara, you can jump in at any time. When we started to talk about it, you know, what I was saying to Barbara is we have to, as a white society, to say out loud what the problems are, what we are afraid to talk about and deal with, what leads us to be afraid to even talk or to say we have racism, we have a problem with this. We come from a culture that has had it, just like you said, Dave, mm-hmm. for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm.
And I think if I may interject here, first and foremost, I think it's really important for us to acknowledge those feelings. And I think this is where sometimes the conversation goes awry. Because if people aren't comfortable enough to acknowledge the feelings of ambivalence, the feelings of guilt, the feelings of why do we always have to talk about race? I hear people saying that. The feelings of, well, but I'm not racist, so what's this got to do with me? Mm-hmm. If people aren't comfortable enough to voice those things, we will never get to the truth. And we will never be in authentic dialogue and conversations with one another, amongst one another, in our communities about this issue.
Yes.
And by the same token, in that comfort of being able to express the feelings that come up whenever people hear that word race, yes. there also needs to be an accommodation made for the realities, the lived realities of Black people in this country. Just yesterday, I listened to a woman who said, well, slavery is gone. This is a white woman. And she said, slavery is gone and done with. Why can't we just forget about the past? It's an ugly past. Let's move on.
Yes.
And so my response to her was, the truth of the matter is slavery is with us now because it was never properly acknowledged and given space before. The result is the remnants of slavery, the institutions that were set up during slavery, are in full operation today. So That having been said, she got shook up a little bit because, again, it's that discomfort. Can we just bury this and pretend it's not happening? Meanwhile, it is very much happening and it is very real. And a lot of people, because of the enclaves in which they live, and this is the thing about what has made it so sad. What I've found is that community dialogue amongst peoples or groups of people is going to be tough because people are living in silos and enclaves. I live right now in a neighborhood where, quite frankly, what's going on the streets of Detroit or the streets of Ipsy or the streets of Chicago is so far removed, Mary Grace. If I had the privilege to ignore that, I would. If I had the privilege to shut my eyes to that noise, I would. All I need to do is switch my TV off, don't go on social media. And you know what? Sitting in my back garden looking at the sky, you'd think I was in the Garden of Eden and everything was well.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're hitting such an important point. And that is, you know, white society has to realize how they are cocooned. That they're not really seeing it and feeling it. And but that doesn't mean it's not there. And if we don't begin to listen to Black society and have those conversations, we can't break out of the cocoon that we're in, especially the more privileged you are. We aren't living, you know, I live in Plymouth. Big cocoon. And so for us to be able to really know reality, for white society, we have to listen. We need to listen and we need to get comfortable listening. And we have to deal with our people, so to speak. I remember reading Malcolm X, you know, years ago in the 90s. And what struck me so much was he was talking to this one white young college student. And she was saying, how do I help? And he said, you have to take what you're learning and go back and talk to your people. That's the key. Stop trying to think you're supposed to change Black culture. That's a part of the problem. We have to really get out of the cocoon, get uncomfortable, and be able to listen and validate. You know, I wanted to talk, and Barbara, we went, you know, real good with this issue where I said, you know, when people say, why are they rioting? Why are they so angry? I'm going to tell you why, because I deal with it every day in my practice. When you have somebody who is hurt and wounded and you deny them their story, their feelings, their wound, they have to escalate to get you to understand. And you ignore them again, or you minimize and you don't value them and you don't give them compassion to their experience, they will escalate and escalate and escalate. The body then blows up. That's a problem.
Well, I want to add too, I think in addition to that, that and that that happens, in addition to that, that this is a systemic issue that has been ingrained in culture for years. And again, it's unfortunate that it takes a death of a human being to bring about a movement that always should be happening. I mean, here's the thing, and I'm going to, a lot of people don't don't comprehend that people of color have always been disadvantaged. And if you look at socioeconomic differences in people raised in poverty, that lends itself to issues. But that's not because of color. That's because of where they, you don't choose to where you're born or who you're born to. And this is the underlying structure of why this has always been a problem, because we don't look to change anything until there's a tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing too. What you have to realize is it's not the death of a single person that has caused what's going on outside. What's going on outside in the protest is actually just a symptom of something much, much deeper that has been going on for longer. Yep. And as Mary Grace says, you know, you can push a human being so far, and then at some point something has to give.
Yep.
And the death of George Floyd is not the most extreme and heinous thing that we've seen. We've seen worse things, mm-hmm. but it is the straw that broke the camel's back. Now, yes. I just want to make a disclaimer right here and now. I am not African American. I am from Zimbabwe. And the first time I actually experienced myself as a Black person ever in my life was an adult when I moved to America. Because where I come from, yes, we have white people. Yes, we had racism. But there's a huge difference there, and I'd like to point this out. We were in the majority in Africa. The whites who were oppressing us were very much in the minority. Yeah. So the dynamic changes because I went to an all-white school. I was one of a few, you know, little chocolate chips and an all-white cookie. I went to a school like that. But guess what? I got to go home to my people. During school holidays and vacations, I got to go to the rural areas, the place of my birth where my umbilical stump is buried. I got to go and be among my people, my own. It's a very different experience for the African American here. And I listened to a podcast by an amazing African American guy who talked about his first visit to Africa. And he says when he got off the plane in Nigeria, he started sobbing. Because for the first time in his entire life, there were people like him around him. He didn't have to feel like he had to shrink himself so as not to be seen. He didn't have eyes on him that told him that he was a menace to society. He didn't have little white women clutching their bags away because they thought that he might snatch them. He didn't have to deal with any of that. He said he felt as though 10,000 ton weight that had been sitting on his shoulders was suddenly lifted and he broke down. Yeah. So I wanted to say this mm-hmm. because I sit in a unique position where I have experienced a different kind of racism in Africa from the kind of racism that African Americans and now myself experience in this country. And the first thing that I want to say is that the systemic racism here is actually the root of the individual racism that we see. There are things in place that were put literally to disenfranchise Black people. Mm-hmm. Jim Crow laws. There's inequality in health and in wealth. There is inequality in education. There's inequality in housing. There is inequality in unemployment. Right now, the average white person makes 10 times the amount of the average Black person in terms of wealth. And they make 8 times as much as the average Latino family. Those numbers speak volume. And they are not based on individual racism. They are based on structural, systemic, and institutional racism. These are racist laws that are enshrined within companies and organizations and institutions, all the way to the judiciary, for goodness sake. If you peruse the documents of this country, there are things that should have been amended that haven't been amended. Mm. So when we look at police brutality, for me, what has been educational for me is realizing that actually the police were slave patrol. The badge of slave patrol is exactly the same as the badge of the police force. And so not much has changed in terms of how they operate when it comes to people of color. This is why you see the kind of insanity we see on the streets, where in broad daylight, in full view of cameras, police will take batons and dogs onto people of color. It shows me that this goes deeper than just individual bad cops. And I refuse to buy that story. Because when I've looked into the documentation of what slave patrol was there to do, how slave patrol was constructed, and I look at the behaviors of police, I'm like, dude, they are enacting what was enshrined in the so-called original police force. So when you hear people of color saying the police force should be disbanded, initially I didn't understand. I get it now. Because anything that is predicated on disenfranchising one group or another cannot be cobbled later on with reforms and amends to become something else. The very foundation is rotten. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so this is why people right now are saying we need to scrap and start over. Because anything we try to fix and amend, we're just putting band-aids on a really deep-rooted problem. And we've seen historically it hasn't worked. This isn't the first spate of riots. What was the summer of what? What year was that? The summer of whatever. These riots are cyclical in this country. Mm-hmm. It's like this craziness happens and it's going to die down. And then things are going to go back to normal. Yeah. And then it's going to escalate again until breaking point. And then we're going to have another slash and burn. And at some point, and I'm praying this is the point now, at which we all say, Black, white, Asian, at which we humans say enough. Let's do the dirty work now. Let's dig up the rot now and be done with it for the sake of our children to come and their children's children.
That's right.
We can't keep doing this.
That's right. You know, as I was listening to you and I've seen some of these writings on Facebook where people will say, yeah, but there's really good cops. And I want to address that. I want to say something to the people that write this because they're missing the boat. Someone just told me a great analogy. And he said, you know, when they say Black Lives Matter and somebody writes, you know, well, all lives matter. You say, well, you're missing it. If I were to say we need to protect and take care of the rainforest, it is dying. We are mistreating it. We don't go over and look at this tree in your yard. And it's like the person saying, come and look at this tree, though. This tree's all right. That's in your yard. Look at this tree. Look how beautiful it is. You're missing the point. We're talking about the rainforest, which is being eaten up, and some of the toxins we're producing are killing the rainforest. And so I'm getting really frustrated with things that I'm reading because I keep seeing the white culture. You're missing it again.
Here's the thing, Mary Grace. It's really simple. No, all lives do not matter. If all lives mattered,
we wouldn't be
Black having bodies wouldn't be, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Right. Okay.
So that's the first thing. So when somebody says all lives matter, my thing is no, all lives don't matter until Black lives matter. Because right now Black lives do not matter.
They
and
don't.
That's the God's honest truth. It's not, nobody's making stuff up. This is real.
That's right.
You Black lives do not matter.
And you so, know, I want to go right at that, Barbara, because you and when we were talking, you know, remember I had a list of those questions that I think white people have to ask themselves. If we are all equal and everyone is important, you know, in our white neighborhoods, when you see a Black man walking with a hoodie, what does your body do? Do you take a second look? Because if you're taking a second look, you got to check yourself. You got to go after that very subliminal racism that is there. If an African-American child comes to play with your children, do you go outside to check out what they're doing? Do you suspect something? If so, you have to check yourself. When you're driving in a territory that you don't know and you notice Black people, what do you do? Do you lock your doors? This is some of the subliminal racism that we have been growing up with and surrounded by that is very, very real.
And, you know, it's funny you say this, Mary Grace, because, you know, I just had an image of children. And again, the question came up, well, you know, how do we get rid of this racism? And I said, first and foremost, as adults, you do the work yourself. There's a lot of implicit biases that go on. And what people don't realize with children is that children learn not by what you say, but by what you do and what they feel from you. So, for example, if you're walking with your child and you're holding her hand, or you're not, she's busy skipping in front of you, and there's a black man coming towards you, and you say, come on, Jenny, come on, come on, take mommy's hand, take mommy's hand. And you take her hand and you hold it just a little too tight, and you say, you know what, let's cross over, let's cross the street. Mm-hmm. Don't for a minute think, don't for a second think your child has not noticed what just happened.
Yeah.
There's a man who's a man who's dark-skinned coming. Mommy has taken my hand. She senses everything that you're going through in your body. She's holding me a little tighter than usual, and she's just made us cross the street. Do that often enough. And this is why when people say to me, I say, racism is given with the mother's milk. Mm-hmm. I mean that in that sense, that it is, some of these behaviors are so learned that when you start pointing them out to people, they're shocked. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, I'm not racist. I'm like, no, honey, you are. You are. Majority, if not all white people, are racist until they do the work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Until they do the work of vomiting this toxin out, until they do the work of removing these internal implicit biases that they inherited from their forefathers. Mm-hmm. The fear of blackness, the fear of dark skin is so insidious and so embedded. Most people aren't even aware of how they are enacting their fears out on a daily basis. This is what us Black people call the microaggressions of racism. Where I go to the grocery store and I am pushing my cart and I am minding my own business, and suddenly there's a white clerk who's walking around me pretending to be packing shelves, but one eye is on me. That is a microaggression. Maybe her manager sent her to do that, but maybe it's her own internal biases that say, well, there's a Black woman in this store. Let me just go in that area to make sure she's not stealing something. I have this happen to me all the time, Mary Grace. I go to Macy's. If I go to any of this high end, mind you, it doesn't even have to be high end. I've had this happen to me in Walmart.
Yeah.
I have to laugh. It's ridiculous. But these are the microaggressions. And because you can't put your finger on it, it hurts like hell. But you cannot put your finger in it because the person did not open their mouth to say, hello, I'm just watching you because you're Black and you might steal. But the messaging is very clear. And this is the messaging that children, white children, are getting off of their parents. They don't need to say a word. Their very behaviors and actions. So when somebody says, how do we get rid of racism? The first thing I say is do the internal work. Challenge your own implicit biases. Question yourself every time you see a Black person or a Black man and you feel some type of way.
Yes. Yes. It's start with accepting it is there. Say, yes, it is there. There is a problem. And then face the feelings that come. I've talked to quite a few people in the last few weeks. And one woman had said to me, you know, Ford is really, you know, partaking in trying to make change in this issue. And Bill Ford has asked them to form groups to begin conversations, direct conversations. And one woman said, I'm scared. She was white. I'm scared. And I said, good, good. Now, what are you going to do with your fear? start when you go to talk, say that. I'm scared to talk about this. I'm scared because I may say something that hurts you and I don't even realize I'm hurting you. I'm afraid to even speak. Great. You just started the conversation. Get comfortable in that way. And she was supposed to do some leading of groups. And she said, how do I lead this? I said, you say that. You say to the table, I don't know how to lead this. I haven't faced my own. And I'm going to ask all of you African-American people to step in. And I'm going to do my work to listen and be guided. Tell me your story so I can hear them. Awesome. You've just been highly effective. We have to stop denying it. We have to stop being embarrassed. And we have to stop closing it off and disconnecting because it's so uncomfortable and then running the other way.
The other thing too, Mary Grace, that's really important, and I wanted to address this very quickly, is the issue of shame.
Oh,
you know, I want to talk about this because it is really important. There is a lot of shame in white people about racism because the ancestry is not good looking. Mm-hmm. The ancestry is not nice. I don't know what it's like, and this is where the empathy comes. I don't know what it's like to be in a white person's body with an ancestry like that. I don't know what it must feel like to be a white person with an ancestry I look back on a bunch of pillagers, rapists, slave owners, colonialists. I don't know what that feels like. But what I can do is hold space for you as my sister friend, other women who are my sister friends, to say, I don't know what that's like. Yes, I sit with my own pain about all this, but I'm here. Can I hear you and what this feels like for you? Because it must feel awful. I know there's a lot of shame around this, but the problem with shame is this. One, it is useless as an emotion. Two, is a self-inflicted, and just like guilt, doesn't get us anywhere. What I want us to see moving forward on is, feel the shame, feel the guilt, and then can we get into the business of doing the work?
Oh, Barbara, and we lost your volume.
Hold up, I got her. She's still going.
Okay, I lost it. Okay.
So what I'm trying to say here is this. Where you will find Black people getting really impatient is with what they call privileged white tears, where white people will want to sit with the guilt and shame. Because you know what that does to us? It makes us start feeling sorry for you. Mm. And it's weird. It's like a weird thing that happens. And I've had this. I've had a friend call me the N-word. I'm not going to say it.
Yeah.
She was so shocked. We were so close. She was so shocked that this word slipped out of her mouth. She broke down and started sobbing. Do you know what ended up happening? I ended up comforting her and telling her it was okay. Mm. Now, here's the thing that must not and should not happen. What needs to happen is let us be. Sorry about this. Somebody's trying to call me. Let us be conscious of each other's discomfort with this topic, each other's discomfort with the fact that we have to have these conversations. But let's each side own whatever it is that you're going through. And the best way to do that is to vocalize it. I feel shame. I have a friend who said to me, I'm ashamed to be white. And I said, that doesn't help me in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't. What's your shame about being white going to do for me and the millions of Black people who are out there being pillaged and whose bodies lie on the streets? That's not what needs to happen. Because when you do that, you spin the conversation so it ends up being about you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what you want to do is feel what you feel, vocalize it, and then come up with, what can I do?
Yes.
How can I do? I always believe there are four things to this. First is acknowledgement. Then you get the apology. Then you get the atonement, and then you get the amends. These are what I call the four spiritual pillars mm-hmm. of getting right with yourself, getting right with your neighbor, and getting right with God. Yep. These four things need to happen.
And I think clarity needs to come, because that issue with shame and what it ends up doing, and it ends up flipping it around onto the person in that should not be receiving the compassion in that moment. And you are then not tending to the victim. There is a huge difference between shame and remorse.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Remorse says, I am so sorry. When I think about what has happened to you, it breaks my heart. There are these mistakes that our community has made, and we are sorry for that. How do we change this? What do you need right now? That's remorse. Shame and guilt spirals. You go into a place of a victim, and you feed that victimhood that makes the person who is wounded have to tend to you. It doesn't help anybody. So the tip here is remorse. Sit on the side of remorse. Imagine, you know, and Dave, we get sexual assault victims.
Well,
Barbara, yeah. You know this, in our office. And, you know, sometimes it's a family member. Sometimes it's someone that the person knows. So we get these families that come in, say a brother assaulted a sister. And we have to deal with the same dynamic mm-hmm. where the parents want her to understand why her brother assaulted her. And I have to go, stop.
Or worse, they don't want to acknowledge it because they don't want to be in the place of being responsible, because in a way they are. And that's the worst thing, because they don't acknowledge it and pretend it didn't happen.
Forcing that victim in the place of, you've got to understand, you've got to do the work.
Yeah, and exactly it. This is the thing. And you hear this a lot. Well, you know, the rioting that's going on, well, that doesn't solve anything. That's just like destroying their own communities. And I sit there and I'm listening and I'm thinking, you know, once again, you're evading the issue. And all that is evasion. Mm-hmm. So when somebody wants to go to a place of guilt and shame, you're evading the key issue. Okay. When somebody wants to make the victim, is gaslighting. When you want to, in the end, make your victim feel like they're the ones who've wronged you, because now you're crying and you're sobbing, that is evading the issue. And where this is going to get really uncomfortable in these conversations is that no more evasion.
Yeah.
No more. This is not a game. We do this work now or we perish. Mm-hmm. And I get the sense, Mary Grace, you know, you and I communicate and interact on a spiritual level. I just get this sense. This is it.
Yeah.
I really get the sense that if this issue is not dealt with now, we're not going to get another cycle to do this. This is the last cycle of this craziness. And that's why I keep saying to people, for my audience and for people I interact with, my appeal was, can you please start doing the work, my white compatriots, my white allies? It's one thing to put a fist up that says Black Lives Matter. It's a whole nother thing. It's a whole nother thing to go deep inside you and start doing the individual work.
Right.
Because the systemic racism and the institutional racism can only be dismantled when the critical number of white people say, we need this dismantled. Mm-hmm. By ourselves as Black people, we've tried and we've tried and we're not going to do it. We're not going to make it.
Yes.
That's why for me, allyship right now is a lot more than words. Allyship right now is if you commit to doing this work. Allyship for me is when you commit to showing your children how to do by doing the work yourself so you can model the good behaviors.
Yes.
Not just what you say to them, but how you actually live your life and how you are interacting with members of the Black community. That for me is real allyship right now.
Yes.
Once there is a critical number of white people doing this work and coming to full consciousness of the damage that has been done and is being done, I truly believe that we will see the change that we're looking for.
Yes. Yes. And we have to talk to our white society about anger, because when Black people come to us angry, we have terrible responses to it. Jesus Christ. Oops, sorry. Are you okay? Here's where I go freaking Italian on your ass. Are you freaking kidding me? You know, the one thing about Italian culture is we're okay with anger. We really are. We're good at it, man. We get mad at each other and curse each other, and then we hug and we eat. I mean, that's just the way it goes.
Right.
There's a great number of white society that as soon as an African American, a Black person gets angry, they get scared, they get paralyzed, they get judgmental. They begin to gaslight and turn it around on them. What I am wanting you to do is I need you to work on getting comfortable with anger. First of all, if you ever sat in their shoes, you would be furious. Believe me.
And you know, to that point, Mary Grace, that's why I said on both sides, there needs to be, when we have these hard conversations, there needs to be the ability to hold space for one another with uncomfortable feelings. So if I am angry and I can articulate to you why I'm angry, you as my ally, you as someone trying to work through this with me, must be able to hold space for me and contain my rage. And that's anger, right. And understand it is a centuries old rage. It isn't a rage that is born from George Floyd having a knee on his neck by a white officer with a hand in his pocket and a smirk at the camera. No, it goes back deeper. Mm-hmm. So this is why I'm like, the work that needs to be done requires courage on both parts.
Yes,
because on my part, the worst thing, here's the worst label you can ever give somebody like me, the angry Black woman. Ooh, call me that, and I feel a wave of shame come over me. Mm-hmm. And I've had situations where somebody will step on my toes and I'll be like, excuse me? And they're like, oh my gosh, you're angry. And it's like, it's an accusation. It's not a statement of fact.
That's
I'm actually being accused and shamed of being angry. And yet the truth of the matter is I have a reason to be angry. You just stepped on my toe, dude. Mm-hmm. Right? But it's like, it's as though people of color, and I want to speak to this because this is really important. It just came. Their health documents, you know, I'm in public health. There are documents that were written in the 18th century that described people of color, the Negroid, as being devoid of the ability and sensibility to feel pain the way white people are. Do you know what happens in hospitals as a result? African Americans and Black people do not get proper pain management. Do you see how insidious this stuff is? We don't get proper pain management. Sometimes people have had surgery on them with no pain medication because of documents that were written. And now you talk about institutionalized racism. There are documents now that debunk those things. But what has stayed embedded in the psyche of white physicians, white nurses, white psychiatrists, white doctors? Is that we are subhuman. And that's what this boils down to. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when I had the C-section with my twins, I'm lying back there, and I use the story to demonstrate anger. Mm-hmm. I'm lying in there. A psychiatrist comes in with a team of students, was at the U of M. This psychiatrist starts talking about me, tapping my belly, I'm lying back, as though I'm a piece of meat. The most he said was introduce himself, I'm Dr. So-and-so. Didn't even have the courtesy to say, I have students who will be observing with me today. Mm-hmm. Note what's going on here. First and foremost, it is assumed that I'm a low-income, African-American, probably single woman, who is now having a third pregnancy with twins. They had a discussion about me as though I did not exist. And some of the things that were being said in terms of pain management alluded to those horrible documents. So they're busy trying to tighten up how much epidural medication I was going to. Do you know, I sat up and I roared.
Good for you.
And I said, how dare you stand here with your students? You haven't even introduced them to me. And you have the nerve to talk about me as this. And this is how they addressed this group of people.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So you see, with this group of people, you have to look out for this and this. And it is documented that these kind of people have this and this and their ability to feel pain. They are much more sturdy. Blah, 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 blah. I fumed. Mind you, I'm getting ready to deliver a set of twins. So I already had it about up to here. 36 weeks and I was done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know
and what? I really want white people who are listening to really absorb what you just said. They really have to understand what happens for Black people when they need medical help. Because racism is so strong there. Look at this pandemic. Look at the numbers. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me for this. But I think the statistics, it was 40% higher Black deaths than white people.
You're correct. And it's not just in the US. It's not just in the US, Mary Grace. It's in the UK. To the extent that in the UK, physicians and healthcare workers, the disparity was so great that physicians, Black, Asian, other colored physicians and nurses said, we're not going to work. Something is not right here. How is it that there are less doctors and nurses who are white, who are dying, than they are us? And it's come out now, again documented, that there was a difference in the kind of care that was delivered to Black people versus white people. Now, look at the history in this country. We've got the Tuskegee studies, in which African-American men were denied treatment, simple treatment with penicillin, in order for white physicians to observe the natural history of a horrible disease like syphilis. They watched men who had syphilis progress until death from syphilis when there was medication. Note, these men infected women who were pregnant and who bore syphilitic babies. And all these people, that whole group of people, was used to study the natural history of syphilis. This is where, again, when people say, where does the anger come from? It's like, are you kidding me right now?
I know.
The anger is real and it's based on real things. Now, if this stuff had been redressed and we were not dealing with these same issues, if we were not dealing with these same issues currently and today, yeah, somebody could say, you know what, could you people just get over it already? Things have really changed. But the truth of the matter is nothing has changed. And when people look at health disparities, I'm a public health professional. I can talk to you about epidemiology and infectious diseases. I can talk to you about what diseases look like. In every single category of disease in this country, except the ones for genetic predisposition, African-American women are the highest by far. Not even men, the women. From obesity to stress to heart disease, to diabetes type 2, to cancer. surely this is not genetic. Surely this is social and societal. And then when you look into the treatment of people of color when they have these diseases, when you look at what contributes to somebody's health and wellness and what doesn't, you start to find that it's all interwoven. This is the intersectionality of the issues that Black people face. Poor housing equals poor health. Mm-hmm. Poor dieting, poor nutrition equals poor health. Low income equals poor diet, equals poor housing, equals poor health. Do you see how all these things are interwoven? Mm-hmm. And so when you have a system that is set up and built to disenfranchise a whole group of people, guys, we got to be real. Something is going to blow up somewhere. Mm-hmm. So for the people who are saying, why is there rioting on the streets? You have no idea the rage in which we are all marinating. Yes. And when I say all, I don't mean Black people. We are all, this entire country right now is marinating in Black rage. We got to find our way out.
That's right. And it starts with white people listening. Stop denying. Listen. Empower.
And change.
Well, it's change, but it's also, again, the anger element. Like, people have to learn how to get comfortable with it. You just sit in the space. Just sit in the space.
But you guys just heard me rant. Mary Grace.
Right.
And that's Dave, Dave, right?
Yes.
Dave, you guys have just sat through a rant.
Uh-huh.
Was I angry? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good for you.
You sat with me.
I blame you.
You sat with me while I did this. You didn't interject. You didn't. I don't know what you're feeling right now. I don't know whether defenses went up or not, but you're sitting in space with me and you're hearing where this rage is coming from. And you're hearing my experience as a Black woman and the things that I've had to go through. You're hearing me.
And that is
the first step to be able to sit with that discomfort. It's an uncomfortable conversation. I know it.
That's right.
Well, and let me say too, Barbara, not only hearing you, we're listening. We're not just hearing it. It's not just something that's out there. We're listening to you express your pain and frustration. That is the key.
And validating.
And validating. Because Mary Grace said, you just said it a moment ago, a lot of people are like, oh, it doesn't exist. They deny it.
But what about this? This is the most famous white person thing. But what about this? But what about reverse discrimination? What about this? And I want to shake the shit out of them. And again, say, and Dave, we know because we deal with this issue every day with victims. You need to shut up and listen. This person got hurt. Plain and simple. This ain't about you right now. It is about this person who's been through trauma and pain. They're wounded. Shut the fuck up. And just listen. And don't try to figure anything out. Just be present and let them know, God darn it, they're not all by themselves. You care. And if you don't know what to do, say that. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I'm not really sure what to do right now. But I'm here. Good.
Or what
crap.
Can I do? What can I do? And maybe,
what do
maybe
you
don't
need?
Have the answer, but that's what we figure out together.
Yes.
And here's the thing, guys, too, just to let you know, because of where I come from. This is why truth and reconciliation commissions are very important. This is why after the genocide in Rwanda, after apartheid in South Africa, there were truth and reconciliation commissions where literally all it was groups of people, Black and white, listening to Black stories, listening to people. They didn't walk away with any money. They didn't walk. But the idea that you had a group of people supporting while you told your story and they shut up, nobody asked you any questions, nobody uttered a word. And people tore their clothes in anger. People screamed the roof down in anger. people rolled and writhed on the floor in agony as they told their stories, and you had to sit and watch and bear witness.
Yeah.
Sometimes that is all it's going to take for someone to start their healing journey.
It truly
is for somebody to just bear witness to the pain.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yes, that's right. That's right. You know, you guys, this is so important. And Dave, I'm Barbara, you say, what are you thinking about? I'm thinking, gosh, I want to have this time is going too fast.
Yeah.
And I would like, I don't know, Barbara, if you can next Friday, but I don't want this to stop.
Let's not.
Great.
Let's not stop it.
Let's
not stop this conversation until things start changing. I'm here for the things.
Yeah.
I'm even thinking something more. I'm even thinking we get together as a group and do our, I don't know what we'll do. We'll do a Facebook Live every week just to continue to do this.
Yes. And I think let's plan that in this podcast next Friday, we're going to continue this conversation though.
Well, and what I want is because we have a week to do this. I want people to get online. I want them to interact. Mm-hmm. I want them to ask questions. I want them to be involved.
When I put this post out here that we were doing the show, I got the thing that bothered me. We had so many people like it. We had a few people that we had a couple of white people in there that did their, white Confederate flag thing and deleted them and made them have no voice, which I felt powerful in that. But what saddened me is the majority of the people who liked and shared it were of the Black community. White community show up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking, it's me, kumbari do kumbari here. From me to you, listen to me. Show the hell up. Join us in the conversation. If you can't listen to it when it's live, like Dave said, write to us.
Mm-hmm.
Message us privately and say, listen, this is what I'm afraid of. This is what I think about. I had an argument in my head with you, Mary Grace. I didn't like you very well. Okay, tell me. I'm okay with that. I'm freaking Italian, for God's sake.
I love that.
Tell me. You're pissed at me? You didn't like what I said? Then help me to understand where you're coming from and let me bring it to the table. And Dave, too. So that we can move this along and be those beacons of change.
Yes.
Be those change agents. But let's not be afraid anymore.
And I want to add, you don't have to be part of a million person movement to make change.
Like
I said earlier, start with yourself.
That's it.
And powerful. That will affect everyone around you.
That's it.
Powerful. It's powerful.
And that's literally where I'm at. I'm a grassroots activist.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we have the huge Black Lives Matter movement. Please do plug in. I know that there are people in my circle who've asked, where do we get resources? Here's my answer. I'm not doing anybody's homework for them. If you go to Google and you Google, that's all you need to Google.
Right.
Resources for anti-racism work. There is a slew of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most I can do. But the work is going to have to be on you. These conversations need to carry on. And all of us need to take ownership of our part in this struggle. I work at grassroots level. I'm about the one-on-one individual. The big organization, there are people who think they can just go and make a donation and that'll solve everything. No, honey, it's not. I'm here to challenge you to go deep inside. Right. So even if you donate $10 million, I'm still going to challenge you to go deep inside. Because the insidious nature of this evil, is that it stays until it's uprooted and it is passed on generation to generation. Here's something I want to give you guys just to uplift you. If I tell you how many young white women I am mentoring right now who've been kicked out of home, you will sob. They have been disowned, they have been disinherited mostly by dads.
Oh, I know.
For supporting this cause. And all I say to those, and this is where I have said to them, as an adult, not even as a Black adult, but as an adult, period, our generation has failed you. And I am so deeply sorry.
Yeah.
We have failed our young people. When you have young children going to Davos, Switzerland, to protest environmental issues, we have failed.
Yes, we have. Yes, we
and
have.
I said this to these young women. I said, remember, in every single part of the world, whenever change has come about, it is because young people have gone against the wills of their parents. Mm-hmm. It is because young people have kicked and bucked at the status quo. It is because young people have shamed their parents into doing the right thing. So you know what? You are on the right side of history. And if there's no adult anywhere supporting you, you have me. I'm a big kid at heart. Mm-hmm. So I'm with you. Mm-hmm. And this I share to show that this work is no longer a Black-white issue. This is a human issue.
Mm-hmm.
This issue goes to the core of who and what we are as humans on this planet. And let me tell you something. If we don't fix this, we're all going down together.
Yes, yes, we are. Yes,
all of us. We are all going to go down together.
Being insensitive, and we have to stop this damn detachment from our hearts, from compassion. When somebody sits in front of you and someone is hurting them, if your heart does not hurt and you see color, there's a problem. There's a problem. We have become so desensitized and detached and dissociated that we're not getting those emotional reactions that we should be getting. We as white society, yes, we need to be pissed and embarrassed as shit over our behavior. Period. We need to be saying, we are so sorry. We are sorry. I saw something on Facebook. Oh my gosh, this beautiful woman, she's an African-American woman, posted this terrible story. I just got on there and said, I am so sorry you had to see that. This is wrong. This is just wrong. My heart is broken.
And she's, you know, Mary Grace,
she sent me a heart back. And it's wrong. It's wrong. And we have changing to do. We have changing to do.
Yep.
White people have changing to do. And we got to own it.
Yeah. And thank you so much for this, because, you know, one of the things that I get a lot from like white allies is, you know, they'll write, I see you. I hear you. I stand with you. Mm-hmm. And then I go and I write, please do the work.
Yeah.
Because it's no longer enough to see me, to hear me, and stand with me. Do the work.
Yep.
Do the work. Do the work. This is where it's at. You get into action.
And the work has all of this treasure on the other side. It's got gold on the other side. It is so huge that it's priceless. You know, I have this story I've shared, I think, before about, you know, God gives us all a bag of shit. And he says, listen, I'm giving you free will. Go forth and conquer. You can turn this bag of shit into gold and treasure. Just deal with it. Look at it. Play with it. Smell it. Touch it. Deal with it. And watch what you grow. Watch what happens to you. And the first guy to talk to God got all excited. And he took his bag of shit and he went and he sat down and he looked at it. And the second time, the second guy was watching and thought, what the heck's going on there? And the second guy went up and God said, here's your bag of shit. Go forth and conquer it. I give you free will. You have the choice. But if you face it and deal with it, you will turn it into treasure. And the second guy said, I don't want that. That looks uncomfortable. And God said, no, everybody gets a bag. listen to me, you can turn this into treasure. And the second guy goes, but I don't want it. God said, you must take it. And he's pissed. Well, the first guy sees the second guy's done and he runs up to him. He's all excited. And he's wanting to show him his shit. But the second guy pitches his and walks up to the first guy and says, hey, what's up? And the first guy says, look at what God gave me, this bag of shit. And the second guy goes, geez, I don't know why God gave you that. I didn't have to deal with that. And now shame and embarrassment has begun. Cover up has begun. And that first guy just deflated and felt embarrassed and was afraid. And we got to go back and we got to tell everybody. And, you know, we talk about it. I say it all the time. Hey, you know, turn your crap into treasure. Don't let your crap control you. You take control of your crap. Love it. Laugh at it. Some of this crap is funny as hell. Don't be afraid of it. And if you don't know what to do, say that. And watch what happens. Watch what growth and wisdom is really like. It's freaking awesome. It's amazing. So I know I'm surprised.
Yeah, we're over a bit. So that's cool.
Surprising enough. So we are going to continue this show next Friday night. We got Barbara coming back.
So in the meantime, let's find out where people can find us. Let them know Mary Grace so that we can communicate during the week and let people communicate to us.
You can, of course, find Psyched by MG everywhere, Spotify, Pandora, podcast, Instagram, Facebook. Psyched by MG is in Twitter. You can find me. I really, really hope you will message me and let me know your thoughts.
Yep.
Hard as they may be, I will read them.
And you can find me at Motor City Hypnotist on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and look forward within the next 2 weeks to the Motor City Hypnotist podcast. That announcement. We'll be launching that within the next couple of weeks. A little bit of a different twist. We're going to focus a lot on hypnosis, but it is going to be also focusing on mental health. And I have a lot of surprises. I don't want to give too much away, but it'll be fun.
But Dave is still going to be on our show.
But I still will be here. Yes.
Yeah. He's not hosting here.
I'm not leaving. I'm just adding to.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And Barbara, where can we find Barbara?
Well, you can find Barbara very simply on Facebook, Barbara Mangami. You can find me on Instagram at BeHealthFreak. And if you really want to go deep with this, you can find me on the Tickety Talk because I am doing a series of video on there at TikTok.
Oh, nice.
Tickety Talk, love that.
I have a series of very short videos. You know, we only get 60 seconds where I highlight some of the historical facts that are sort of underlying what we're seeing today. So, thank you guys.
Yes. And on that note, thank everybody so much. Again, we are live on Facebook every Friday night at 6:30.
And again, shout out to Podcast Detroit for hosting us and our fearless producers, Matt and Jamie.
Hey.
Yes.
You got it.
And thank you very much for joining in tonight. We hope to see you next Friday.
All right, folks, be kind.
Yes, please.